the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church and the world, and we kind of just say just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. I am delighted to be here this week. I just got back from a conference in Germany, and I'm going to be speaking with one of the guests today who was at that conference, who I thought's insights and kind of analysis of what was going on was pretty insightful. So I'm grateful that he's kind of agreed to be our guest in the first part of our Just Love show. I'll talk more about that conference in a little while. I also want to kind of compliment God this week because I think he finally decided we're going to get some spring. And so I think we're doing pretty good. So God, thank you for the better weather that we're happening. You weren't too bad on us with the Northeast this year, but I think what you did was you let us get a little complacent in February because we thought, you know, we had it beat. And then you said in March, you know, I want to remind you that I'm in charge of this. So, but God, thank you. It's April. We're glad that you're there. I mean, it's the end of April and it's kind of, we're just beginning May. So we're grateful. And so it's delightful to kind of be here back from Germany. And I'm going to be happy to kind of share with our listeners some of that experience with our first guest who's going to be with us in a few moments, Tob Weggott, who is the Director of Ethics and Spiritual Care and the Chief Operating Officer of a healthcare facility in Germany. So I'm delighted that he's going to be with us. And then kind of that conversation is going to be about, you know, how do we think about our Catholic identity when we do social service work, when we do healthcare work? How do we think about that as being a reflection of our faith? How do we kind of embed our Christian values in that work in the midst of a work which we help people of all religions and we, you know, hire people of all religions? And I'm actually going to talk with Tom about that because I think we have a little bit of a different way we approach that in the United States as we do in Germany. So I want Tom to kind of share with our listeners some of the way that that's approached in Germany. So after that, we're then going to speak with Sam Tadros, who is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. And we're going to be talking about, again, religious freedom, religious identity, and in light of Pope Francis' recent trip to Egypt, we're going to talk a little bit about the situation of Christianity in today's Egypt. You know, we often talk about Coptic Christians, which is basically kind of a little bit of a transliteration of a word which simply means Egyptian Christians. And boy, they go back real far. They go back to the apostolic times. And so we're going to talk about that because, you know, the situation of religious freedom there is not what we would expect it to be or not what we'd hope it to be. And then so there's some real discriminatory practices that are part of the fabric of that part of the world even until this day. So I'm delighted we're going to be speaking with Sam Tadros about that topic. So, and, you know, we're now into the third, fourth week of Easter, so we're kind of continuing to move along. I have to say I did tweet out this week, but I'll share with our listeners, with all of the conversation about, you know, the evaluation, the assessment of the first 100 days of the Trump administration, you know, okay, 100 days of the Trump administration. Well, the reality is that there have been 83,000 days of American presidents since George Washington. So, like, so 100 days, we've had 83,000 days of presidents. So 100 days, I'm not sure that's such a, you know, such a big thing that we should make a big deal about it. Maybe not ignore it, but it's not a big deal in terms of the life of the American presidency. And the other comparison is, so we got 100 days and, you know, they're all debating what were the accomplishments, did things get done, things not get done. Well, all right, I like that. But what about How about a special 50 days? Let's look at that. How about the 50 days of Easter?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Day one, we had resurrection. Day 40, we're going to have ascension. Day 50, we're going to have the sending of the Spirit on Pentecost. I think that's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Those are 50 good days. I think I'm going to vote for the 50 days of Easter above any 100 days of a presidency. So anyway, so that's what kind of think about. I'll share a little bit later on some of my other perspectives on my trip to Germany. But I do think, let's go to our first guest. Our first guest is Tom Wiegand, who is the Director of Ethics, Spiritual Care, COO, of a healthcare facility in Germany. Tom, thank you so much for agreeing to be with us on Just Love today.
It's a pleasure for me. Greetings from a cold, rainy day in May.
Germany. Well, we have a nice sunny day in the United States, in New York, so I'm going to convey to you our warmth and our sun and whatever. But given that you're ahead of us by 6 hours or so, don't you be sending us your rain and cold by the time we get a little bit later this afternoon, okay? You keep that to yourself.
So I'd be happy to be on the sunny side of the street.
Ah, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. So, Tom, I want, you know, we spent 2 days speaking about and listening about the identity of Caritas. And for the sake of our listeners in the United States and for one of our presenters there who was from Bangladesh, who was very, very clear that all the countries of the world, every place, should be using the term Caritas to refer to kind of the social assistance, the healthcare work that the Catholic Church does. But in the United States, we call it Catholic Charities. When I talk about Caritas, I'm talking about Catholic Charities. I'm also talking in some parts of the country about Catholic Community Services, Catholic Family Services. But for the sake of this conversation, I'm going to just use the word Caritas as a shortcut for understanding what we mean by Catholic Charities, the work of social help. So, Tom, would you just broadly share with our listeners kind of the way you saw the conference, the conversation that we had there in trying to understand better the Caritas identity from the conference? So wherever you want to begin is fine with me.
So considering the 2 days in Berlin last week, I went there with the idea of having a change of perspectives in a broader frame. So that was your person give us a talk about Catholic Charities in New York. And we had a colleague from Caritas Austria, the General Secretary, and we had a member from the Caritas in Bangladesh, which is almost a totally different framework from the Western world. And I was amazed about the situation in how totally different circumstances Caritas is a vivant organization, and so it's an expression of the Catholic Church worldwide.
So could you share with our listeners what were some of the new perspectives you had that maybe you didn't have before the 2-day conference?
So as Germans, we are almost focusing on things like law, on what is correct and how can we fulfill guidelines. And a really good change of perspectives was it's important what we are doing and in what kind of attitude we are doing things which are based on the gospel of Jesus, and that we could focus much more on what happens and not to focus on what's going wrong and what are we lacking of.
You know, Tom, we're speaking with Tom Wiegand, who is the Director of Ethics and Spiritual Care and the CEO at a healthcare facility in Germany. And we're speaking about a 2-day conference that I was happy to attend in Berlin last week on the identity of Caritas as a ministry, as a work of the church. And so, so Tom, you know, it's interesting. I think, you know, there is what, from my perspective, there was a lot of similarity in what was going on in Germany and the United States. While at the same time,
absolutely.
But while at the same time, you mentioned some differences, and you know, and as I think I said in the conference, I do have, going back a number of generations, some German roots, and so I think I can have a little bit of understanding of at least that perspective for kind of wanting to know what the rules are, where I can go, where I can cross, where I can't cross. So I think I have at least a little bit of an appreciation for what you spoke about. But speak a little bit more about the different perspectives that maybe you heard that were a little bit of a difference from that.
Yeah, just considering the situation of Caritas in Germany, as some of your listeners might know, we have the reunion of Germany in 1989, 1990, and the eastern part of Germany is almost atheistic because of these decades of communism before. So a lot of facilities of Caritas in the eastern part of Germany have a lot of employees which aren't Christian, either Protestant nor Catholic. On the other hand, they are seeking for a fulfilling work in social context. And so that is the one part of Germany. On the other hand, the western part of Germany, foremost the southern part, is deeply coined also from the Catholic Church. And we are facing a change of bonding to the church in terms of being a member, active member of a parish, visiting the mass and so on. And what really urges us on is to help those who are in need. And this still works in different contexts. In Germany, it works in the US, it works in Bangladesh. And this is focusing on the whole world and looking, on the other hand, how can we continue in Germany?
So let me share with our listeners the perspective that Tom opened up about Bangladesh. And for our listeners, let me break down the numbers so that you have a sense of the context. So first, let's do the how big those various places are. So there are about 320 million people in the United States. There are about 160 million people in Bangladesh, about 80 million people in Germany, and about 8 million people in Austria. Now, not exact, but that's an easy way to remember it. 320, yeah. Half is 160, half is 80, and then 10% is Austria. Now, again, with a little bit of difference for our listeners, you know, Germany and the United States, you know, not exactly the same, but you have a lot of Christians, you have a lot of Catholics, and a lot of Protestants. Now, the United States probably has more Protestants than Catholics. Germany might be a little bit closer. But in both those countries, whether they're atheists or people who are just non-believers or agnostics. So that's kind of the picture there. Austria, not necessarily a question of how practicing it is, but of those 8 million, apparently, you know, well over 50%, maybe closer to 60% are Catholic. So it is a majority Catholic country. And then, now listeners, I want you to pay attention to this. So in Bangladesh, a country of 160 million, there is less than 1% Christians.
0.2, yeah.
0.2. So, you know, what, Tom, what's that translate to? About 500,000 Christians, maybe, out of, you know, out of 160 million. It's not a great number, is it, Tom?
Absolutely. If I consider that the German Caritas has more than 600,000 employees in whole of Germany, it's amazing if you compare the numbers.
Yeah.
But as we listen to the colleague from Bangladesh, the small number is very well appreciated in the whole of Bangladesh. They get support by the government and also by the people.
Yes, and wasn't it interesting that he told us that apparently the government has formed some type of economic development commission to look at how the economy there needs to be developed, and they've asked him to be part of that because of the respect that Caritas Bangladesh has, even in the midst of a country which is so overwhelmingly non-Christian.
I guess the witness itself, what the people working for the Caritas are doing in Bangladesh, is working for itself. So you can convince people by doing the right things.
Yes. Now, the other thing, which, again, I think for our listeners may be very interesting, is what our colleague in Bangladesh said, and this would be probably a little bit of a surprise to those of us in the United States, and Tom, you can tell us about Germany. He said they begin their day with prayer, and they begin it with what they call universal prayer, where they provide the opportunity for those who are of various religious beliefs to kind of use that as an opportunity to pray in a way in which they are most comfortable. And I found that to be a very interesting point that was part of how they see their identity as Caritas Bangladesh.
Yeah, absolutely. That was my impression too. The consciousness the Caritas members of Bangladesh are having during their work is somewhat different from what I experience from the broad majority in Germany. So most of our employees also are working as physicians, as nurses, at whatsoever, to have a job serving and helping people. That's the one thing. The other thing is, can I connect what I am doing to my own beliefs? And this was a really good example what the Caritas member of Bangladesh told us at that conference.
Yeah.
Maybe we are too shy to speak loud in terms of praying, but also in terms of institutional values about our roots in the gospel.
You know, Tom, we're speaking with Tom Wigan, who's the Director of Ethics and Spiritual Care and the CEO for a healthcare institution in Germany. And we're speaking about a conference that both of us were at last week in Berlin, looking at how does one look at the Catholic identity of our helping institutions, healthcare, social assistance, charity, from various perspectives. And I think, given how different it is, I think both of us were very, very much attentive to what we were told by our colleague from Bangladesh. And Tom, I want to pick up on that word that you shed. And, you know, maybe in Germany, maybe in the United States, I would probably say yes, in the United States, we have been a little bit too shy about allowing our Catholic identity to shine forth. And again, from the perspective in the United States, we always have an approach where we do not proselytize. In other words, we don't say to receive assistance, you have to become Catholic, or we're only going to serve Catholics. But that doesn't mean we can't allow to show forth the witness from our Christian values that motivates our institutions to engage in these works of kind of building the human person and helping people. And so, Tom, I think the comment you made probably is something that maybe we need to think a little bit more about in the United States, and I would probably say Germany, as to how we allow that to come out. And isn't it interesting somebody from a complete or almost totally non-Christian country has something to teach those who are in more Christian countries?
I guess it's a totally different kind of my own personal and existential decision to work on the fundament of my own beliefs, because it's not, as we could say, normal in the context of Bangladesh, where Christians are a vast minority. But let me just focus on another point we stressed in Berlin.
Please.
But when we mentioned about a little bit being shy on speaking in terms of prayer or our institutional values about our Christian fundaments, we have in our mission statement, in our organization, which is carried in the majority from the Order of the Brothers of Mercy, of Mary Help of Christians, also a nursing order in the Catholic Church. We have clear the mission statement that this is as a service of charity, as witness of the gospel of Jesus. So it's totally clear in terms of words, but what do we mean using these words? Are these words going to be understood by nowadays people, by our employees, by society? Or have we to be much more careful using these words because they are not being understood by the people in our countries?
Right, and I think that is a very, very good point. I think the two parts of that point are, one is we have in most places, the United States, I believe also, we do have the right words in most of our fundamental documents and in our statements. But two parts to that. One is, how are those words understood in a world and in a culture which is clearly less practicing of religion than it would have been a generation or two ago? And secondly, how do those words get translated into concrete actions and expressions in the work that's being done? And so I think two of those are challenges that we face.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a kind of transfer and translation work which has to be done, and it has to be done in our parishes and in our institutions of the Catholic Charities, of the Caritas.
Right. Hey, Tom, you've been so generous with your time, and thanks for accommodating us, even though there's a 6-hour difference in time. So I appreciate your accommodating your schedule to meet our schedule. And so thanks so much for being with us on Just Love this day. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Great. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Tom Wigand, Director of Ethics, Spiritual Care, COO, of a healthcare institution in Germany. And so we're going to continue our conversation when we come back, but now we're going to take a break on Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. I want to give thanks to God today because I think spring has finally come, and I think I'm asking God that we keep spring in the air. So, I mean, it's after Easter. We're third, fourth week of Easter, and so I think we should kind of stay with spring. We did enough during March to kind of deal with the end of winter, so I think we should keep going forward. We're talking today about an issue kind of religious identity, religious freedom. I was just at a conference in Germany, in Berlin, in which the topic was, well, how do we have our do-gooding, which I'm calling it, our do-gooding, which is basically our social services, our health care, our social assistance programs, the help that we do to kind of people in need. How is that reflective of our Catholic faith? We have big organizations throughout the world, Caritas in most of the places, Catholic Charities in the United States. And how does the identity of that we do this kind of as a reflection of our Christian faith, how does that manifest itself in the identity of the organizations that we have? Because we do it in a way that we don't proselytize. We don't say you have to be Christian or Catholic to get our service. We even say, you know, we're open to people of all goodwill. If, you know, they have the skills and want to work with us, they understand our identity. But how do we do that? So that was the conference I was at. And so we're kind of following up today. We just spoke with Tom Weigand, who is the COO of a healthcare institution in Germany. And we're going to kind of do a little bit in a little while to deal with a, you know, a different aspect of that, where in parts of the world, the notion of that one is a Christian is not really respected in law or custom, in full participation in society, and there is discrimination against that. And we're going to be focusing on Egypt because the Pope, you know, just recently went there. So we're going to be speaking with somebody, a scholar who is very, very up to date on what's going on with religious freedom in different parts of the world. And we're going to speak with him about Egypt. But before we go there, Tom, are there any news items that you want to share with our listeners?
There are, Mr. You know, we can, you had mentioned before a little bit about the nice weather we've been having up in the Northeast. And of course, we just passed by Earth Day. And so what we can do is we can do a little bragging here locally, Monsignor. Catholic Charities Community Services of Rockland just recently on Earth Day unveiled a new greenhouse on its property in Haverstraw, New York. It was funded by a grant that was gotten through Rockland Assemblyman Ken Zabrowski. And it's actually the first of its kind, Monsignor. It's the first greenhouse in the New York region to be constructed for the benefit of a food pantry. Now, of course, Catholic Charities Community Services of Rockland already provides healthy food choices for hundreds of families each year. And they also give through generous donations of Stokes Farm and Tappan and growing their own vegetables. They also have fresh produce available. But now what we are going to do is use the garden and the new greenhouse to provide fresh produce all year long, and additionally offer educational opportunities to teach children and adults about farming and the value of growing and eating fresh vegetables in a positive environment.
Hey, that's great. That's great. So is it up and running yet, or is it going to be up and running? What's the story?
They dedicated it, so it's up and running. I think they have just, you know, probably baby fruits and baby vegetables growing at this point now. So
so the greenhouse means that you can grow stuff that needs a warm environment. You can grow it even in winter.
Exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. So they'll be able to continue to have the fresh produce that, you know, we generally give to people during the summertime.
Hey,
but we
kudos. That's a good deal.
Yeah.
Good deal.
That's
okay. I like that news story. Okay. You're not going to give us any downer news stories next, are you?
Well, there is a downer news story.
All right. Go ahead. Go ahead, Tom.
There is one, I would say, Monsignor. Now, unfortunately, as you know, we covered this a little bit on Just Love 2. Down in Arkansas on April 28th, the governor there, Asa Hutchinson, is resisting demands for an independent inquiry into an execution that some witnesses there said briefly led to a condemned man to convulse and cough. The alleged episode happened back on April 27th at Southeast Arkansas Prison, and it happened minutes after the condemned man, his name was Kenneth D. Williams, was injected with a large dose of a drug called midazolam, which is a sedative that's been subject to legal battles and widespread scrutiny after a series of controversial executions. Governor Hutchinson has stated that he sees no reason for the investigation other than a routine review that's done after every execution. And Williams' execution was the last, ending a series of legal and political challenges that had begun when the state originally, at the beginning of April, had planned to execute 8 murderers in 2 weeks' time. They wound up executing 4, and court rulings delayed the execution of the others indefinitely.
Well, Tom, my feeling on this is really pretty strong with regard to this. I mean, I do think, from our Catholic perspective, a consistent ethic of life makes us to oppose the death penalty. Let's just be very clear about that. I mean, I do understand some of the distinctions that are made in the Catechism of the Church about the difference between reaching this judgment or when are the conditions. I understand that. But the reality is that we pretty much have reached a conclusion around which there is a fairly strong consensus, which might not be 100%, but a fairly strong consensus, that the state using capital punishment to deal with capital crimes is not something that is really in accord with our Catholic social teaching. A little bit of disagreement, but for the most part, capital punishment is not something that is part of our Catholic social teaching. So having said that, and it's consistent because we believe that life should be not interfered with in that negative way of taking it from the first moment of contention to the time of death. And we believe, however, that people who commit capital crimes should be capitally punished, but not through through execution, not through that. So maybe not capitally punished, but they should be punished seriously for the violence they've done, for the killing in most cases that they've done. So anyway, so we're not saying people shouldn't be punished. We're just saying that capital punishment carried out by the state, and it seems to me that where we have gotten in the world is so incredibly convoluted, my opinion, that it even adds to the fact why capital punishment isn't something that should be done. I mean, the fact that they rush these through because the expiration date is of the drugs, and they can't even get the drugs right. I mean, they can't do it. I mean, you know, I mean, we all have watched the Wild West, and we've watched those where, I mean, it seemed, again, we're against capital punishment and all, but it's certainly there was a much cleaner way that they used to do it in the Old West. Mm-hmm. We all see those movies where, you know, there's awful firing squads and it happens and it's quick, it's over. But I mean, it seems to me that in our modern era, the way we've kind of moved this is it even adds to the fact why this is not a good way to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, to say it in a very, very, you know, of course, we can't even figure out a way to kill people. Mm-hmm. I mean, and shouldn't that tell us something about maybe overall this isn't the way to kind of deal with crime? This isn't the way to deal with retribution. It's not the way to deal with a just punishment for a very, very awful crime. So, you know, Tom, thanks for bringing that to our attention. It's something that's sad. But I have to say, I think one of the things that we can be a little bit hopeful about is that the number of executions are steadily decreasing, mm-hmm. not only throughout the world, but in the United States. And so it's moving in the right direction. We're not there yet. And there clearly are blips at times in which, you know, states try to move to get to execute more people for a variety of reasons. Anyway, enough on that. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to speak about the situation of Christianity in Egypt. We're going to talk about the Pope's recent trip there. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. Our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a minute or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. You know, this week we're talking about religion, religious liberty. We're talking about religious identity. And we spoke about the issue about how to infuse a greater sense of Christian identity, Catholic identity, into the social service work we do, the healthcare work we do. And now we're moving to a related topic, not by any ways the same, but it's how do we deal with the fact that we live in a kind of multi-religious world. And in some parts of the world, there's not the concept of the same religious freedom that we seem to take for granted in the United States. So I am delighted that we're going to be speaking with Samuel Tadros, who is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in the Center for Religious Freedom. We're going to be speaking about primarily, but we may talk about a few other things, the situation of Christianity in Egypt in light of the Pope Francis's recent trip there. Samuel Tadros, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love today.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So let me ask the question. How did you kind of originally get interested in this topic of religious freedom?
Well, I couldn't possibly have escaped it. I myself am a Copt from Egypt. Okay. So growing up, the questions of religious freedom, of equality for religious minorities in the country has obviously been surrounding me throughout my upbringing. I remember vividly my grandfather and the elders of the Christian community in our local village in the Delta in Egypt writing this petition to be sent to President Mubarak at the time, this is in the 1980s, asking that we are allowed to have a bathroom in our church. Because getting a bathroom, getting a wall, changing anything in the church or having a new building required a presidential decree from the president of Egypt. So from an early age, it was very obvious that the rules that apply for us are different from the ones that apply to the majority population, that there were restrictions on our religious freedom, and we needed to fight to get our right to pray peacefully.
So let me ask you this question to give our listeners a sense of this. How big is Egypt? How many people in all of Egypt?
We're talking 93, 94 million people.
Okay. And of that, how many Christians?
Well, God only knows is a good way to answer it.
Yeah, but let's us humans take a guess.
Yeah, the Egyptian state refuses to declare a number. Precisely because it's afraid of people, well, if we say that the number is 10%, then they're going to ask for 10% of things. They're going to wonder why they are being discriminated against, why they're not allowed in certain positions, and so on. So officially, the government doesn't give us a number. Estimates vary dramatically from as low as 6% to as high as 15%. So it's anyone's guess, basically, what the exact number is. I would go with a lower estimate and say maybe 8% of the population is Christian.
Okay, but I mean, we probably have 6 or 7 million to say 6 or 7 million out of 93 million, which is that, and because we just were talking about Bangladesh, which is less than 1%, where it's like 0.2%. So it is a number. And would the rest of the country be primarily Muslim?
Yes, the rest of the country would be Sunni Muslim. There are a few Baha'is, a couple of thousand in the country. There are about 10 Jews left in the country after the community has been driven out in the past decade since the 40s. So we're basically talking there's the Christian minority and a Muslim Sunni majority. And of course, even if the Christian minority in the country represents less than 10% of the population, that still makes Egypt's Christian population over 50% of the Christian presence in the Middle East. So if you add up all the Syrian Christians, the Iraqis, the Palestinians in Israel, in Lebanon itself, the Maronites, all of these combined, their numbers are less than the Copts of Egypt.
Now, we're speaking with Senior Fellow Samuel Tadros of the Hudson Institute. And we're speaking about the situation of religion and Christian religion in Egypt. So, I mean, what you just, I think, conveyed about the situation a number of years ago, of needing permission of the president of the country to add a bathroom to a church. I mean, I think that's incomprehensible to our listeners out there. Well, why should they care? I mean, you already have a church. Maybe we could understand they don't want you to build a new church, but why not a bathroom? I mean, it seems incredibly oppressive to kind of go to that level of micromanaging, you know, a church building. And you mentioned that was a number of years ago, I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Until the year 2005, when President Hosni Mubarak changed the law, making the establishment of new churches still requiring the presidential decree, but making the renovations, adding bathrooms, making the wall around the church higher, adding the door, these simpler things now require a governor's signature and not the president. So it was a move forward, but still you needed the governor of that state you're living in within Egypt to sign on, well, adding a bathroom.
You know, our experience in the United States is that sometimes that's good and sometimes that's bad, because depending on who the governor is, you may get more restrictive policies than if it was a kind of a general national policy. So how has that worked out? Has it permitted greater freedom in the way it worked out?
You've pointed out to the problem. We've got 27 governates, so we've got mixed bags. We've got governors who are generally lenient, so they signed on these requests and they're like, sure, why would I bother with it? But then you've got others that were, well, less tolerant of Christians, that harbored hatred towards them. But even when you had the good governor, the combination with, well, the security services are involved in this issue as well. And that point is, you ask the question of why should they care about the bathroom? Yeah. Precisely because they view the Christians overall as a security question. We've got these people that are different from the majority, that are a potential threat in this sense. We need to make sure that we manage everything regarding them. Yeah. So sometimes you get a good governor, but then the head of the security service in that governate is, well, he's less tolerant, so you're not able to move things there. Other times you've got a good head of the security and a less tolerant governor. So the reality is that the daily life has not changed. The discrimination in terms of the legal framework of building churches, as well as other things, has not basically changed, despite all these political changes going on in the country.
So speaking with Samuel Tadros, who is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, I was speaking about Christianity in Egypt. Now, Sammy, you correct me because you are far more expert on this, but if I picked up a few things that I've heard the Pope say, you know, in the news, so correct me if I'm wrong, I kind of think at least one of the things he said to the Egyptian government, and I'm not necessarily talking about his trip, but even before that, didn't he kind of say, hey, you know, you guys got to step up to the plate and you guys have to do more to protect the Christian minorities there. You kind of can't just, you know, use words. You know what's going on and you need to make sure that they are protected. Did I pick that up right from what the Pope was saying?
Certainly. Pope Francis, since the beginning of his papacy, has made the flight or the plight of religious freedom of religious minorities, Christian minorities in the Middle East, has been at the forefront of the issues that he has cared deeply about. He's talked about this ecumenism of martyrdom, of blood, where we Christians are united, despite doctrinal differences that have persisted throughout the centuries. We're united by this blood of the martyrs. And that's a central theme, really, that he has stressed over and over again. So he's really paid attention to this issue. Of course, during his visit to Egypt, he needed to balance that with also the Vatican's interest in having a serious dialogue with Al-Azhar, the leading Sunni Muslim institution that is in Egypt, and Al-Azhar does not welcome discussions about the persecutions of Christians in the Middle East. If we recall, the dialogue between the Vatican and Al-Azhar was broken off in 2011 precisely because the Vatican issued a statement condemning the attack, the bombing at the time of a Christian church in Egypt. So the Pope was walking a very thin line between stressing the plight of religious minorities, protection for these Christians, at the same time reaching out to the Muslim institutions in order to build a dialogue and better understanding between Christians and Muslims worldwide.
So would you just say a little bit more about the institution or the university that we're talking about that there was a little break off from? Because I'm not sure I know as much about it as I'd like to, and maybe our listeners don't either. So what was that institution you were talking about?
Al-Azhar, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, Al-Azhar is the most important Sunni theological institution in the world. Of course, the world of Sunni Islam, like Protestantism, doesn't have a pope. There's no central authority. So we're not talking about a leader of the Muslim world. Yeah. Nonetheless, Al-Azhar has been an institution of learning throughout the centuries that has played an instrumental role in the world of Sunni Islam. Students from as far away as Indonesia and Nigeria travel every year to study in Al-Azhar University Islamic subjects, jurisprudence, and so on, and before returning to their own countries to become imams and leaders of the Muslim community. So it's an important institution that's really the most obvious leader or most important institution of the world of Sunni Islam.
So let me just, for the sake of doing a little translation for our listeners, I know it's not parallel, but it, you know, might be the Harvard, which has educated more American presidents, I think, than any other single institution, or it might be the Oxford or Cambridge of England. I mean, it's kind of the place that a lot of people look to as kind of leaders in thought. It's probably not a good, not a perfect analogy, but it does it have something to do with that?
Yeah, it's produced the religious figures, the imams, the leaders of mosques. It obviously hasn't produced the political leaders of any of these countries, although the former president of Indonesia, Abdurrahman Wahid, for example, was a graduate of Al-Azhar, studied there. But it is the institution where Muslim scholars are produced every year. It's where they go to from across the world, basically.
So is there this? I'm just intrigued by this. So is there a parallel Shia theological institution?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to study Shia Islam and become a serious scholar, marja'iyya, they call them, reference point or reference leader, you probably would either go to the city of Qom in Iran or study in the Najaf and Karbala seminaries in Iraq. Okay. These are the centers of Shia learning.
Okay. So let me ask your assessment. We're speaking with Samuel Tadros, who's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, the Center for Religious Freedom. So I want to ask you two questions. They're related. How would you assess Pope Francis's trip to Egypt? You said he had to walk a line. Did he walk it well? Did we make some advances? What's your assessment of his trip?
I think he did a fine job given the circumstances. There were a couple points that he did in his visit. He reached out to Al-Azhar. He attended this conference and gave a speech with the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar. So that dialogue is going to continue. Whether it amounts to anything, well, usually these dialogues don't result in major things. But from the Vatican's point of view, having this dialogue between the Christianity's major institution, the Vatican, and that of Sunni Islam is itself a positive development. He raised human rights concerns with President Sisi privately. There was the case, of course, of an Italian student who was tortured and killed in Egypt by the security forces. So he raised this issue privately, making those concerned with human rights happy with that. At the same time, he gave a public gesture of support to President Sisi, who's viewed as a more tolerant leader in Egypt compared to his predecessors. With the Christian community, he reached out to the Coptic Church. We've had this meeting that's extraordinary. I mean, for 2,000 years of Christianity, the papacy of or the Pope of Rome, the Pope of Alexandria, and the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople have never met for 2,000 years. Even during the late...
Well, there weren't these people for 2,000 years, so they couldn't have.
No, I mean, the even during the late antiquity, when you had the great councils of the church in Nicaea and all of this, never did the Pope of Rome attend except the fifth ecumenical council, where the Pope of Alexandria wasn't present. So this is the first time in history where these three great sees of Christianity, of Catholicism, of Eastern Orthodoxy, of Oriental Orthodoxy, hold this public meeting together. The statement that Pope Francis and Pope Tawadros of Egypt issued was stressing the idea that we are striving towards unity. We want to unite the body of Christ as it should be. We want to unite our churches. We're working on this issue, and we see each other as brothers, with the blood of the martyrs uniting us, despite whatever theological disagreements we still have.
So we have just a minute or so left. Samuel, let me ask your assessment of the future of Christianity in Egypt. And I do it against the background that in other parts of the Middle East, there is a real fear expressed about some, is that there may not be any Christians left in a generation or two. What's your assessment of the future of Christianity in Egypt?
It's not a positive one. We have a continued wave of immigration that has been taking place for decades now, accelerated by the Arab Spring. Just to give an example from the United States, in 1971, you had only 2 Coptic churches in the United States. Today, you have 250. That's a reflection of not new converts to Coptic Orthodoxy, but of the immigration of Egypt's Christians to the United States.
And have they settled in any particular place in the United States?
As with other immigrant communities, they usually come to the coastal areas. So New York, New Jersey, and LA were centers. But then as they settle down and become more American, they tend to move like other Americans to Tennessee, okay, to Michigan, to whatever jobs are.
Samuel Tadros, listen, I want to thank you because we're unfortunately out of time, but I found this conversation to be incredibly interesting, and I hope you'd be open to coming back again on Just Love so we could kind of continue the conversation about this topic and others.
Certainly. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thank you so much. Samuel Tadros of the Hudson Institute. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. God, neighbor, self, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Thanks for being with us on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.